Welcome back to Proverbs on Through the Word, chapter 25 today. And here at the Wisdom Roundtable, once again, back by popular demand, are the ladies of wisdom. First, my bride of 21 years, Andrea Langham.
Hello.
And returning again with her is our dear friend, Bethany Wilson. Welcome, Bethany.
Thank you.
Now, let me ask you ladies a question. Looking here at wisdom, what do you think is the importance of wisdom in the work of a mom?
The importance of it is it's needed daily.
So all the time.
It's extremely important. I just remember bringing Abby home as an infant, and just that verse in James came to me where the Lord said, if you lack wisdom, ask the Lord, and he will give it to you. So that has been my mantra all through raising kids.
I think you need wisdom every day. Your job never stops.
Yes.
Yeah, and you get these little kids that come into the world all with their own personalities mm-hmm. and sets of problems that you might have never dealt with before. Mm-hmm. So you don't have a manual for your specific kid. Yeah, there's mm-hmm. good parenting books out there, but mm-hmm. they don't necessarily deal with your trial that you're going through. So you just need wisdom. Like, yeah. I've never dealt with, you know, night messes before my kids or, you know, tantrums besides my own.
Yeah. And the danger of the parenting book is the one size fits all that right. doesn't fit your kids. And so that requires wisdom as you mm-hmm. read through them sure. so they don't just become a guilt trip. Yeah. I think moms require a special brand of wisdom mm-hmm. just to be a mom, because the daily activity of motherhood is intensely demanding and it always puts you in the role of problem solver. Kids run into problems constantly, mostly with each other, and they come to you to fix it. Mom, this isn't working. Mom, Johnny hit me. Mom, dog has fleas. Sally won't stop. Math is lame. Flea bit me. Johnny bit me. And you become the solver. And there's entirely too much biting going on in your house. All of that requires wisdom. So thank you, ladies, for bringing your collective years of problem-solving wisdom. Let's jump into Proverbs 25. Mm-hmm. And speaking of moms, let's begin with the mother of my kids. Andrea, you have the first verse.
Okay, Proverbs 25:20. Whoever sings songs to a heavy heart is like one who takes off a garment on a cold day and like vinegar on soda. And I think this is such a practical proverb and such a practical chapter, really. How do we come alongside someone who is in deep pain or mourning? Mm-hmm. And as humans, I think there's a tendency to try to make the hurting just stop or go away. And I've heard stories of people trying to comfort others, say with dealing with the death of a loved one by saying things like, "Rejoice, they're with Jesus now." Or quote a scripture in an attempt for like a quick fix, if you will. Mm. It's singing songs to a heavy heart. Mm. And I get that, but trying to just be cheery or tell the hurting person to cheer themselves up is like taking someone's jacket on a cold day. Mm. They need to grieve, and you're taking that from them. Mm-hmm. Or like vinegar on soda. It's painful and only deepens the hurt. Mm-hmm.
So what do you think? How do you come alongside someone with a heavy heart? We'll offer my solution, which is something I like to call stop it therapy. It's entirely a joke and not good for helping anyone, but it is a hilarious sketch. Look up Bob Newhart, stop it therapy. But my serious answer, though, is from the Bible. Weep with those who weep. Rejoice with those who rejoice. The Bible calls us to compassion. That means we suffer with someone. We serve the Father of all comfort. Comfort means come alongside. The picture is of someone who is down and you sit alongside them. Mm-hmm. We comfort others with the comfort that we also received. Mm-hmm.
I think for me, I have learned so much from Andrea in that she just listens. She just listens. She doesn't offer solutions, really. She's just like, I'm sorry. There's that empathy or sympathy or both that goes with it when she's listening to what you're sharing from your heart. And it's just like, I'm sorry that's happening, you know, and that brings comfort. And the other thing that I think of is Bill Ferris, amazing marriage and family counselor. I was talking to him and just like seeking wisdom for how to help somebody who is grieving. And he said a lot of it is you do, just like Andrea was saying in that verse, is you do have to allow people to ride the wave of grief. Allow them to be sad, allow some times of anger, you know, all the steps of the grieving process, allowing them to go through that and listening to them, just being there for them.
Yeah, the entire process is important. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to move on to Bethany's verse. Bethany, what did you pick out for us?
So I chose verses 6 and 7, which say, "Do not exalt yourself in the presence of the king, and do not stand in the place of the great, for it's better that he say to you, 'Come up here,' than that you should be put lower in the presence of the prince whom your eyes have seen." So we recently went through the book of 1 Samuel in our women's study, and I was doing a study on humility because we were talking about Saul. So I was looking for leaders that were actually humble in their leadership. So I Googled the term humble leaders, hoping to find a story about a great leader who is characterized by humility. What caught my attention was a study that was done on successful businesses and their leadership. And the number one attribute in the leaders of these successful companies was humility. And these were secular companies, not churches. Jesus echoes this proverb in his parable in Luke 14, where he warns us not to think of ourselves more highly than we ought. He tells them, "Whoever exalts himself will be humbled. He who humbles himself will be exalted." When we choose to take the lowest places out of our true humility, James tells us that the Lord will lift us up. He'll use us to glorify his name in his way and in his time.
Yeah. I love the picture that Jesus paints of showing up at a banquet, taking the lowest seat. It just makes life so simple.
Yes.
We are freed from the burden of being our own hype man. Let someone else do it. Mm-hmm. And we can simply honor others and consider ourselves with sober judgment. Mm-hmm. Just be yourself. It allows you to be comfortable in who you are because you don't have to hype yourself up. Mm-hmm. And if somebody honors you, great, but just be yourself.
Yep. Right.
Well, Andrea, you have the next verse for us. What do you find in verse 28?
So I have, "A man without self-control is like a city broken into and left without walls." And I think I picked this one because self-control is such a key in our walk with the Lord. Mm-hmm. Jesus has given us freedom, right? But we need to use that freedom for his glory and not just to run wild. I think in our walk, all good things come. We have given so many good things in our lives that we're now free to do, but it must come in balance. Mm-hmm. Balance in our money, our time, our food, etc. God gives us all things richly to enjoy, but when we lose self-control in any area, it tends to throw everything off. Like, for example, the cell phone, right? People are probably listening to this on a cell phone right now.
In a balanced way.
In a balanced way.
Always. Self-control.
Self-control.
They're not on Candy Crush, are they, right now?
Well,
terrible.
I'm actually on Candy Crush right now.
Right this second. Yes!
No, but phones are great, but if we don't practice self-control with our use of it, then it kind of throws all kinds of things off, from relationships, even to money. You know, if we get sucked into searching certain apps, shopping apps that will remain nameless in my life, or whatever, it can throw off our money and things in our home lives. We need to find balance, and that takes self-control, because without it, it says that our lives become like a city without walls and are ripe to be broken into.
I think the danger of lacking self-control is the whole world. Everything becomes dangerous. The word picture in the proverb is perfect. In Bible times, a city without walls faces danger in every direction. Nothing is safe. Without self-control, every temptation can kill you. I remember back when our kids were young, I remember that you set out M&Ms out in a dish and you left them where the kids could reach them and they were little. And I remember I put them away and you stopped me because our kids had to learn self-control.
That sounds like me.
I thought my philosophy was just keep dangerous things all out of the way. But it was an important lesson that we gave them. We let temptation sit out there and taught them how to control themselves and gave them consequences when they ate what they weren't supposed to eat. Well, I picked Proverbs 25:2. "It is the glory of God to conceal a matter. To search out a matter is the glory of kings." It's a beautiful proverb here and an essential truth for every scientist, philosopher, theologian. God conceals, we search out. It is his glory to conceal. The mysteries of the universe are God's glory. Glorious means weighty, eternal, having substance that lasts. Our run-ins with glory are like touching the eternal plane. And that happens when we search out the mysteries that God has hidden. That, it says, is the glory of kings. The glory of leaders and pioneers among us who dig in, who ask, seek, and knock. And after several thousand years of exploring our world, what's amazing is that there's still so much to discover. And now, this is important. There is supposedly a separation between science and faith in God. But I think that's thoroughly unbiblical. It's a construct of religion gone wrong. And it's, of course, supported by atheists, but too often it's also supported by a fearful and controlling church. For a believer, there is nothing to fear in truth. and in the honest scientific pursuit of it. God calls us to search out mysteries. Now, I was a scientist before I was a believer, and I became a believer when I finally got totally honest and humble about my science, and I let my pursuit of knowledge become a pursuit of truth. And suddenly I found faith and science to be fully compatible. In fact, they are necessary companions in truth. And I learned that lots of my science heroes were strong Christians. Kepler, Galileo, Pascal, Isaac Newton, a brilliant man, adamantly defended the Bible and wrote commentaries on Daniel and Revelation. You know, I'm recently reading a fantastic book. I'm enjoying Evolution 2.0, Perry Marshall. He's an electrical engineer, information scientist. But aside from that, what I really like about the book is the fearless approach to evolution. There is a danger for a Christian to think fearfully about evolution. Evolution is a very broad theory. Parts of it I fully agree with. I see sound evidence and verifiable evidence. Large parts of atheistic evolution I find totally unfounded by evidence and the hypotheses pressing on scientific absurdity. We see that the code nature of DNA does support adaptations in living things, but zero evidence that random or accidental mutations are ever beneficial. In fact, the idea of randomness is scientifically unverifiable, and we've never seen it happen in nature. And how did the code language of DNA create itself? We have great evidence that bacteria actively adapt, but monkeys to humans is pure theory. Similarity does not prove ancestry, but there's no fear in searching it out. And that brings me back to the verse. To search a thing out is the glory of kings. God has called us to it. Well, we have plans for a series on science and Bible coming up, so I will save the rest of my rant on that for another recording. Please pray for that one. Bethany, Andrea, thank you for joining us in the studio again.
Thanks for having us.
Everyone else, we will see you back in Proverbs 26.
Join us next time as we continue the journey, one chapter at a time. And remember, faith comes by hearing, and hearing through the Word.